It is especially nice to see you this morning, Don Packer, and your wonderful, supportive daughters who are with you. If you are a welcome visitor this morning, I need to explain that this is the final sermon in a brief series on the Reformation movement. We have talked about how urgently the church needed to be reformed in the 14th century, and then about Luther's leadership of that movement. And last week, we talked about John Calvin and the shape he gave to Protestantism in Switzerland. This morning, we sketch how the Reformation spread across England and created in the process our own congregational ancestors. When Henry VIII took the English throne in 1509 at the age of 18, he was truly the golden boy of European royalty. Handsome, athletic, a musician with two masses to his credit, which are still preserved, even something of a theologian, having been aimed first for a career in the church. Sir Thomas More said of Henry that he has more learning than any English monarch ever possessed before him. And everybody marveled at the new age about to dawn under this prodigy. Probably no one could have dreamed, however, that this loyal Catholic youth would turn against the Pope and create the Church of England with himself as its head. But rebellion against the Roman Church was on a great many minds by 1521, when Henry was 30. Oxford students were buzzing about Luther's revolt, and many noble English families were itching to get back some of the properties that had been given to the church by their pious ancestors. By a conservative Catholic estimate, the church owned about one-fifth of all the properties in England. And besides the envy that provoked, the clergy itself was not at all popular. A Catholic ambassador wrote back home from England that nearly all the people hate the priests. And the heretical ideas of Martin Luther had already lodged firmly in English heads. People were talking. Only 3 years before Henry took the throne, 45 men were charged by the Catholic Church in England with heresy. Two of them were burned. In the next few years, 7 more went to the stake. The record shows 342 heresy trials in 15 years. And what were these heresies? Well, for example, that the communion bread remains only bread and does not literally turn into the body of Christ. That priests have no more power than other men to consecrate this bread or to forgive sin, that pilgrimages to holy places and prayers for the dead are worthless, that priests would be better servants if they were married, and that the Bible and not the church should be the sole rule of faith. A Protestant Reformation, in other words, was standing in the wings, but Henry VIII was not ready. Instead, this loyal Catholic wrote a response to Martin Luther, asking in the gentle terminology of the times what snake was so poisonous as to rebel against the Pope. Luther wrote back and gave Henry a lesson in the rhetoric of insult, calling him a clumsy ass, a frantic madman, the king of lies, a damnable and rotten worm. Well, kings are not accustomed to that kind of address. The English king, in this case, never forgave the German peasant. Henry would likely have remained a loyal Catholic, except for a wife who could not provide him with a male heir to the throne. Catherine's first child died at birth. She had a son a year later, and Henry rejoiced, but this infant also died within a few weeks. A second and third son died soon after birth, and Henry began to think about annulment, reminding his country that the marriage, after all, had been forced upon him when he was only 12 years old. But it was not a simple matter to get rid of Catherine of Aragon. She was the aunt of the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, who controlled the Pope at the time, and Henry needed the Pope's permission. It was fascinating for me to read again last week how Henry schemed and plotted until poor Catherine, worn out, agreed at last to go to a nunnery if Henry himself would take the vows of chastity. But nothing was further from Henry's mind than that. By that time, he was not only eager to find another wife who could give him a son, but he had fallen madly in love with a maid of the court named Anne Boleyn. An ambassador from the Pope, trying to resolve the impasse, wrote back to Rome that Henry's passion, quote, is a most extraordinary thing. He sees nothing, thinks of nothing but his Anne. He cannot be without her for an hour. It moves me to pity to see how the king's life, the stability or the downfall of the whole country, hangs upon this one question. Pressured by the emperor, the Pope would not oblige the English king, and finally, at age 42, Henry decided to defy the Pope and marry Anne, already 4 months pregnant with a child who would become the celebrated Queen Elizabeth. The English council, not happy with the Roman Church anyway, conveniently declared Henry's first marriage unlawful. But the Pope promptly pronounced the new marriage null and void, its offspring illegitimate, and Henry excommunicated from the church. Without missing a beat, Henry made himself head of the Church of England. Still a Catholic church in almost every way, except that instead of an infallible pope, it now had an absolute king who punished anyone who tried to carry out the Protestant reforms that had swept the continent. And there were plenty who wanted to carry out those reforms, so eager to purify the church in England, to move it back to simpler forms of worship and organization, that their purifying instinct got them the nickname Puritans. They wanted to get rid of clerical robes, throw out statues of saints, replace stained glass windows with clear and simple light, even give up all religious music not made with the unaided human voice. They were probably naive, these English Protestants, in hoping to reform the church from the inside. They did not get very far, and it was not long before a smaller, more radical group arose among them who felt that this was hopeless and that they should separate entirely from the established church so they could get on with the job. This wing of the Puritan revolt came to be called, appropriately, the Separatists. And when they actually began to meet in separate meeting places, Parliament passed a law making their worship a crime. When many of them went to jail, it became obvious that they would have to leave England or give up their hopes. So they did leave, spent 11 years in Holland, and decided, as the story grows more familiar now to you, to leave for America on a ship called the Mayflower. These Puritans who had become separatists also came to be known as pilgrims, after one of their leaders, William Bradford, spoke of himself and his people as pilgrims and strangers upon the earth. And since they believed strongly that each congregation should be independent of all others and free to call its own minister instead of having him appointed by a bishop, these separatists, pilgrims, Puritans, were also called Congregationalists. And that name was destined to stick when in 1620 they set up the oldest church in New England, the First Parish Church of Plymouth, Massachusetts. We are their spiritual descendants. That first church, which every Congregational Seminary student is encouraged to visit, was described by a Dutch merchant who visited Plymouth in 1627. It had six cannons on the roof, each one able to dominate the countryside with 5-pound balls. When the drum was beaten for a meeting, each male parishioner took a rifle, met in front of their captain's door a fellow by the name of Miles Standish, and marched silently off to church. Once there, they stacked arms, but remained alert, determined to be free, no matter what the cost, and what freedom had already cost, they could easily remember by looking outside at the windswept little graveyard where more than half of their original company lay dead of cold and sickness. These first English settlers were followed within a few years by non-separating Puritans, by those who had elected to work from within the established church for a while longer, but who then came and settled the Massachusetts Bay Colony and gathered another congregational church at Salem in 1629. Between 1630 and 1640, more than 20,000 new arrivals brought their similar convictions to America, and the Congregational Church became, in effect, the established church of New England. From the left wing of this denomination, there would come ultimately the Unitarians, the most liberal church in the Protestant world, and from its right wing would come ultimately the Baptist churches, largest of all the conservative religious groups in America. We may even be responsible for the birth of still another large denomination. Time magazine reported in 1977 on a handwriting analysis that convinced four California researchers that it was not Joseph Smith or an angel that gave the world the Book of Mormon, but a congregational minister by the name of Solomon Spaulding, who had been writing a novel. They claimed that 12 pages of a manuscript of the Book of Mormon contained in the archives at Salt Lake City are in the hand of Spaulding, who was a part-time novelist and who had the training to put such a book together. It makes more sense to me than the Angel Moroni and the Golden Plates, but my Mormon friends understandably reject the idea. The Congregational Church, from the very beginning, put an extraordinarily high priority on education. Their earliest leaders had been professors from Cambridge, and they had no sooner settled in America than they established a college to make sure their future ministers would be well trained. The name of that college was Harvard, and it was only the first of a long line of distinguished universities created by congregational churches who felt that faith and reason, heart and mind, need not be at odds in one's religious life. Yale, Dartmouth, Williams, Bowdoin, Middlebury, Amherst, Oberlin, Mount Holyoke, Beloit, Grinnell, Chicago, Wellesley, Vanderbilt, Pacific at Berkeley, Pomona, and Scripps in Los Angeles all began, along with many more, with congregational sponsorship, along with some others in this part of the world, like Drury in Springfield, Washburn in Topeka, and Wichita State University, which began life as Fairmount Congregational College. But if education was held in high esteem, something else was held even higher, captured in the magic word, freedom. The old covenant of the English Congregational Church in Lincolnshire, England, began, "We, the Lord's free people," and that word free summed up what they determined to be, no matter what it cost. Free to read and interpret the Bible for themselves, free to educate their children so that they could read and interpret it with accuracy and skill, free to grow and change without fear of being tried for heresy. The old Salem Covenant of 1629 spoke of how the church would walk in the ways of God according as he is pleased to reveal himself unto us in his blessed word of truth. If you hear those words carefully, you realize that they tend to rule out the making of creeds. The revelation of God, they suggest, is ongoing. The door is left open for new understandings. It is a prescription for tolerance and reason in religion. for the right of private judgment. People are bound only by a covenant or agreement, voluntarily embraced, and never by a creed shaped by someone else and rigidly bound upon succeeding generations. Now, the result of such freedom, obviously, can be a kind of riotous pluralism that ranges from the far left to the far right, with no one privileged to kick somebody else out of fellowship for not conforming to his or her own interpretations of the sacred word. One of the many things I like so well about Congregationalism, having come to it in the middle of my ministry, is its insistence that every Christian is a minister and a priest before God. In some of our churches, in fact, the bulletin will read like this: ministers, all the members of First Church, staff, and here will be listed the professional and paid members of the staff. I am pleased and honored to be a pulpit minister, granted time to study and bring the fruits of that study back to you on Sundays, but I am only one of many ministers. I have, because of my specialized work, no higher standing with God than any of you may have. And because of that, I have begged boards and committees to remember that meetings need not be opened with prayer by the pulpit minister, but by any other minister of the church. And we do that. A great congregational heritage of freedom is advanced when lay people lead prayer, serve communion, visit the sick, fill the pulpit when I am away. It is no accident that we have men and women in this small congregation who could grace with distinction the pulpit of any church in Wichita. I say that soberly. I suppose that by now it will come as no surprise to you when I say that of all the things I might be, among the many good churches there are, I am most proud and happy to be one of many ministers in the Congregational Church. A church never perfect, to be sure, but flexible and free to move forever in that direction, with tolerance for those whose pace is not the same. I sincerely consider it the crowning achievement of my life as a minister to stand in the pulpit of this free church. So endeth the first series of sermons of a new church year. We will begin another soon.